Welcome to our new PR Week podcast episode with Arvind Hickman.
Hello, I'm Arvind Hickman and welcome to the PR Show. Today we're taking a look at sports marketing and how brands can score gold at the Tokyo Olympic Games. In the dugout, we have a special guest, the British Olympic Association's commercial director, Tim Ellerton. Hello, Tim.
Hi, nice to see you.
Also on our panel is H&K's new MD of sport, Jamie Kuehr, MNC Saatchi Sport and Entertainment's UK CEO, Jamie Wynne Morgan, and the Playbook's head of sport, Nick Meakin. Let's kick off with Tokyo. Tim, can you give us a rundown on the levels of interest Team GB has had from brands and how this might compare to previous games?
I think it's difficult for me to compare, for the Rio cycle. I wasn't in the current role then. Or like I say, at this time, I think in particular as we head into the games year, the interest is, I wouldn't go as far to say unprecedented, but 2012 was obviously a bit of an anomaly in a way because you're hosting the games, so the interest we had the similar numbers in terms of what you were talking about with what's going on in Tokyo, maybe not in terms of revenue, but certainly in terms of the number of sponsors and number of brands involved. Mm-hmm. But I think the success of Team GB in 2016, backing up the performance of 2012 with an even greater performance by becoming second in the medal table, means that brands are interested in what we're about, in terms of that team that really does bring the whole country together, so many different sports, so many different stories. A team of, we'll probably take around 380 athletes to the games this time, with over potentially over half that being female as well. So there's a lot of good stories behind the team, and that's something that brands are, aspiring to, and that's where our conversations are starting to develop more and more over the next few months and hopefully right up until games time.
What do you find is the major draw for brands that they want to get involved? Is the Olympics itself, is it the concept of the Olympics, or is it more to do with some of the individual athletes and their backstories?
I think it's a bit of both. I think the Olympics still, especially if we had a meeting yesterday with an agency talking about Gen Z, which I can't profess to know a huge amount at this stage, but I'm trying to learn. And I think the Olympics is one of those few occasions in life, if you will, that actually really does bring all countries together. And our country in particular has been quite a divisive time recently, and that's why our campaign has all been around what we do to bring the country together and get behind the team. I think that's one of the areas that we're focusing on is, okay, what does Team GB stand for in this modern Britain, and how can a brand relate to that through the context, not just the sports that we're in, but also the athletes who make up our team.
Okay. I might just ask some of the panelists what sort of feedback they're getting from brands. I'll start off with you, Jamie.
Yes, I mean, the Olympics is still a huge draw. It's, I think, by pure numbers, TV numbers, it's the second biggest sporting event in the world. Mm-hmm. It's consistently getting sort of 4 billion people watching it. So from a sports sponsorship point of view, it's a huge draw. So, and it's still, yes, there'll always be, it always seems to draw in negative headlines in the build up to it. About, is it going to be ready on time? Rio had, some really tough issues to deal with. Tokyo doesn't seem to be in the same place as Rio is. But when it comes down to games time, it's such a unique event compared to any other sport. The fact that it only happens every 4 years, the fact that the majority of the athletes are sort of, still considered, not professional. They have to train day in, day out for 4 years to get there. The stories that exist around the Olympics are just, they're unlike any other sport, really. And mm-hmm. I think, brands buy into the stories that they can help align themselves with. If they can find the right insight that's right for their brand, and with the Olympics there will be so many, it's still a huge draw for brands.
Okay. Do you find that time zone makes a difference in terms of when the Olympic Games might be held? If it's, for example, in Tokyo, it might not be at such a watchable time versus somewhere in Europe.
Yep, there is that. But I think the broadcaster, the BBC, have done an incredible job around that. And also viewing habits have changed dramatically now. So actually, the Olympics sort of, ahead of us actually sometimes work better than the ones behind us. So you wake up in the morning, all the good stuff's going to be happening, in the morning into the afternoon and stuff. And the highlights packages and all the cut downs on social media and so on and so forth make consuming the Olympics so much easier. I mean, the numbers that the BBC got for the Rio Olympics, a peak of 51 million or something, which was, up 6 million on even London 2012, I believe. So it's still a big draw. And I think just the modern viewing habits have adapted so much that time differences, whilst it's still a factor and your marketing campaigns need to adapt accordingly, It's not as big as an issue as it was, probably.
And I think just building on that, I think the way in which people consume it, you touched on that, Jamie, you know, this time it's going to be around that commuter period. It's going to be really key. So people will wake up and there'll be medal events happening right from the get-go, right up until lunchtime. You know, wouldn't say it publicly necessarily, but maybe a few people might skive off work and watch the Olympics. That's great. you know, and in the mornings, and then take that period up until to lunchtime. And we also talk about, you know, in 2012, we spoke about the next generation and inspiring that generation. Well, that generation, you know, some of them weren't even born then, and now they're 8 years old, and they're going to be like my kids will hopefully watch the Olympics as well for the first time. And actually, the timings work well for them because, you know, unfortunately, they are up very early. And a lot of the medal events back in Rio were past midnight. So actually, I think, you know, you will lose some and you'll win some in terms of events and the timings that they take place at.
Yeah, it's also a really interesting point, isn't it, about the fact that how people consume media and sport now is so different to how it might have been previously. Previously, it might have been, you know, an event TV moment, whereas now there's all these opportunities on social media and other digital channels to really bring it to life. What are some of the things that clients say to you, Jamie, at H&K? Mm-hmm.
In terms of the technology and the content and the change?
Well, in terms of the appeal and in terms of how to bring it to life.
Yeah. I mean, I think, as the guys were saying, you know, the Olympics is still probably one of the most emotional events that you can be involved in. And having had the opportunity to work at the IOC, and you look at the IOC creating things like the Olympic Channel, you know, it's always going to be emotive content. And as Jamie said, you know, it's really about the storytelling. So brands really need to understand what their space is and how they can use their sponsorships or their partnerships to really tell their stories. And that's, you know, that's important from a Team GB perspective locally and regionally, and also from a global perspective with the money that the top partners are investing.
Yeah. The Olympics, of course, is quite a unique sports event to get involved with in terms of activations. There are some quite strict rules, I understand, in terms of how brands can activate around the Olympics or during the Olympics. Would you like to sort of share some insights, Tim, into some of the restrictions in place?
I mean, I wouldn't call them restrictions, but there are, you know, the Rule 40, which I think you are getting onto, is very much designed to protect the Olympic movement, but also our athletes and particularly our brands. And we hold that very dear. We're 100% commercially funded. You know, we don't take any money from government, which is quite unique in the Olympic world. A lot of national Olympic committees would do that. So protecting our sponsor family is absolutely paramount. And, you know, the Rule 40 does enable to us to do that. And there's been some commentary about that recently, and we're hopeful of a resolution with the athlete group to ensure that we maintain that protection for our sponsors, but we're also maximising the earning potential of our athletes, because of course they are by far and away our most important and stakeholders, you can imagine. So I don't necessarily call it restriction. I think it is quite unique to Olympic marketing, that bit I do know, but I think it's part of the history and tradition of, you know, the amateur side of the Olympics. Of course, it's now as you know, as very professional as any sporting event could be, if not more so. But it is there to protect both parties, and I think, you know, some of the commentary about it hasn't always been fair, and that's why we're working hard with that athlete community to make sure that, you know, everyone comes out of this with the best result possible.
Can you just briefly explain what Rule 40 means?
Well, Rule 40 is designed to protect the sponsors of the Olympics and the Olympic National Olympic Committees during the Games time, so that brands aren't then coming on board and ambushing the Games as such. So that's something maybe perhaps quite different, say, in the football world, where you do see a lot of ambush marketing. Rule 40 is designed to protect the brands that are aligned both to the National Olympic Committees, but also the, you know, the TOPS, the IOC TOPS programme, so the likes of Coca-Cola, Visa, etc.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you mentioned before that there was quite a lot of interest in the Tokyo Games. Can you give us sort of an update in terms of your commercial program, how many brands you've managed to attract this time around?
So our domestic program we're currently up to, soon to be 13 partners and four what we call supporters. Of course, on top of that, you have the Olympic partners, so the global partners, the Coca-Colas, Visas, mm-hmm. Samsungs, Panasonics of the world. That domestic amount, except for London 2012, is our highest amount of partners ever. It's very important that whilst, you know, we have more partners than before, we also take a lot of pride and time and effort and I guess hard work to work with those partners to make sure that they all have their own unique position, if you will, on our partner family, so that companies can exist with maybe perception would be that they're relatively close in category. But what we do is we really create a distinct activation area so that they're not talking about the same thing. They're talking about their own position and their own campaigns in a unique way that allows share of voice to be spread evenly across.
Is there a premium number of partners for the ultimate cut through? I mean, is there a challenge, for example, if you have too many partners that they are sort of competing with each other for time and space?
I think it's going to be very interesting from a Japanese perspective because we've got 63 domestic partners. Now they have absolutely smashed revenue records. I think it's 3.3 billion. Yeah, but you have two airlines, you have two banks now throw into the mix, the top partners. So, you know, it's very interesting. We're talking about what that white space is for the activation. So, you know, interesting because you have to balance that revenue generation and then being able to work with the partners and actually activate. So,
well, I read in the FT that one of the Japanese, one of the brands, I don't think they named the brand, but one of their head marketers said, you know, we spend about $100 million or whatever it might be and there's no benefit for us at all whatsoever because there's so much competition.
Yeah, I mean, do you know what it is? I guess it's hard because I don't want to be comparing how the Japanese market and how we market. Mm. It is a very different style of marketing there. It's very advertising driven. That's not to say it's wrong. So to get the cut through, to do some of the strategic brand activations that maybe we're used to in London or in the US, it's going to be very different. But, you know, again, it's matching up the revenue generation for the OCOG because it is a startup organization 7 years out with the top partners who have rights globally. So it is this complicated constellation of stakeholders in a very complicated ecosystem. So that's why it's very interesting.
I'd like to sort of take a look now at what some of the brands are potentially doing leading up to Tokyo. Does anyone have any good examples that they can share of people they're working with?
I can say who we're working with, but I can't really probably say what we're going to be doing yet. But yes, I mean, look, you know, we worked with Coca-Cola for many years as their sort of Olympic from a global point of view. We're going to be doing some work with Dreams around Team GB, which is really exciting. I think it's a fantastic partner that Tim's brought on board. Mm-hmm. And I think they've got, you know, the reason they're such a great partner, and I think most of the partners have got their, as Tim said, got their own space, and it's key to successful sports sponsorship is there's got to be a reason for you to be there. There's got to be a kind of a truth to it. And sleep is, like the country's kind of since the last Olympics, you know, podcasts about sleep, books about sleep, the country's woken up to the power of sleep. Sleep is kind of as important as training in the day now. So they've got a real reason for being there and they can do, hopefully, with our support, we'll be doing some really exciting and interesting work. So, you know,
I know you can't mention what you're doing specifically, but give us an example of how a mattress company, for example, might activate the Olympics. I mean, the Olympics is about, you know, moving the fastest and jumping the highest and being really active.
Very clever. I know you can't say what you're going to do, but just give us an example. I think it's like, you know, we will be absolutely dialing up, you know, to consumers the importance of sleep. You know, they are the experts in sleep. And so you'll be using, you know, the athletes and the association you have with Team GB, which is, you know, is predicted to be, you know, as successful, if not more successful in previous Olympics. They're phenomenally successful already. So aligning yourself with that success and showcasing how genuinely important sleep is to that success will be, you know, part of the campaign. But no, I'm not going to tell you exactly what we're
doing. It's worth a shot.
So I noticed that there was some teaser content that came out from some of the talent that you were working with last week, albeit not necessarily branded. Yeah. I've noticed that it seems that some of the Olympic partners are coming out a bit earlier than traditionally. So there used to be a sense that, you know, the event would be in August and they would come out June, July, obviously conscious of the Rule 40 restrictions. But one thing that struck me in particular is the Purple Bricks activity. Mm. You know, smart because it's an interesting way of looking at a challenge. You know, what do estate agents and Olympians actually have in common? But also the fact from a business point of view, January is a massive time for estate agents, whereas probably August is not the same. I'm interested to sort of get your thoughts on that, Tim.
That's a great point. I mean, we met with Purple Bricks a few weeks ago and they had, I think, their top trading period for January and the best period they've had for 4 years, or certainly for the first 2 weeks of January when we went to see them. I don't think I'm giving a trade secret away, that actually I'm not so sure they plan necessarily to launch that early. I think they were just so pleased with the content that they had captured and the creativity of that campaign. And I must say, you know, we have Sky Sports on a loop in our office, and it is on a lot of the time. And I don't get bored of it, you know, and I've seen it probably more than most. So I think it's a good example of a partner that's utilising their assets and their association with us, you know, in your perceived work, you know, in what most people perceive as early. That said, if you look at the content, it's not necessarily bespoke to a Tokyo message or an Olympic Games message. It can actually work outside of Games time. Our best example of that is Aldi. Aldi have been with us since 2015. They've renewed with us over until 2025 and hopefully beyond. And they ran Team GB campaigns last year, which was non-games year. The year before, yes, we had the Winter Olympics in February, but they were running campaigns with the Brownlee brothers in the summer of that year, because they are very much set on using Team GB much more than just to play around the Olympic Games. We always talk about, or I always talk about with our partners, and my team do, around make sure the Olympic Games is the icing on the cake. Don't wait for the Olympic Games to deliver everything. That is the best bit at the end, of course. That's when the peak interest is. But your campaign can work hard for you outside of Games time, and the icing on the cake comes during hopefully what will be another successful Games period. And I think that's why they and Purple Bricks and Aldi have gone early, and there's others still to come in the next few weeks.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's a very interesting point that Tim's making. And you know, if you're investing in an Olympic partnership, you need to create that narrative over a period of time. And, you know, taking it away from local for a second, if you look at the top partners, you know, they're investing millions of dollars. And some of them, it's not just about above-the-line storytelling or below-the-line storytelling and advertising. It's actually about creating relationships. So if you look at a business like GE, they went into China and Beijing to create relationships to drive their business. You know, it was 60% focused on the US market. You look at Intel, you know, their story doing by putting technology into the Olympic Games. So it's, if you really have to be, as the guys are saying, be smart about why it is you're sponsoring Team GB or the Team USA or the top partnership. But there is so many things that we need to be thinking about.
And I think, you know, to your original point, right at the top of the show, if you will, around what is the interest levels and why are there such high interest levels in the Olympics? And part of that is, for example, it's not just about an awareness play. In fact, there are many reasons for it. It's about how can we create a partnership around purpose? You know, what is it about CSR? Employee engagement. You know, I work for brand side for 15 years, and I'm, you know, almost embarrassed to say that's not a conversation I had very often, if at all, around why are we doing sponsorships. I think nowadays people have a workforce of, whether it's 32,000 at Aldi or 1,900 at Dreams, 2,500 at DFS. What does it mean for me as an employee of that company, whether I'm CEO or the guy or the girl on the factory floor or anything in between? What does that partnership say about the company I work for, and how can they use that partnership and that sponsorship with Team GB to, you know, motivate a workforce, make them proud, inspire them, do lots of health and well-being activity, which we do with a number of our partners. And that really makes the partnership work a lot harder. And that's my point before, was that takes us away from a program or a campaign, rather, just around Tokyo. That allows us to talk about the Olympic Games in 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, 21, 22, and so on and so forth. And I think that's what makes the Olympic Games very powerful, but also quite unique.
That's quite an interesting point about purpose. And so it's a lot more than just spots and dots now. That campaign really goes for a much longer period of time, and it sort of comes to life in many different ways. Is that what you're noticing as well, Jamie, in terms of how brands are looking to get involved and really take full advantage of their investment?
Over a longer period of time?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yes, it's a one-month, you know, competition every 4 years. But as Tim said, it is about the values, you know, of it. And it's about taking those values and that sponsorship and making it work as hard as it possibly can for as long as possible. There are going to be off years, you know. It will still have an interest, but it's never going to be as interesting in the off years. However, Purple Bricks going early this year is an example. Yes, they probably like the content, but it works, and the consumers are going to buy into it. People are happy to talk about the Olympics. From a consumer point of view, you're happy to engage in Olympic content at any time, really. I mean, the five Olympic rings are probably the most well-known and powerful sporting symbol in the world. Mm-hmm. So it can work at any time. Of course, the interest is going to peak when people are competing and winning medals and so on and so forth. But if you come into it, if you sign up a four-year Olympic partnership and you're going to activate around the month of the Games, then you're really not going to be using your money very wisely at all.
I think there's an interesting evolution as well of Team GB. as an entity? Because London 2012, obviously we knew a lot of the big names going into it, but one of the things that really came out of it was the value of this brand, and particularly going into this, you know, it was interesting having a conversation in the office to the general sports fans and asking them who were the big names going into this Olympics. Now, this is the first Olympics in a long time where there's no Usain Bolt. You know, there's no Michael Phelps. There are obviously going to be big names, but the kind of the Olympic resonance is significant itself. But Team GB as an entity now exists on the level of so many other sports that obviously have the advantage. If you're a Premier League, you can talk about the Premier League all year round. You know, Team GB is able to develop its brand to such that actually it resonates. You know, even in a kind of non-Olympic year.
Okay. Before we move on to other sports, I just wanted to ask each of you, and I'm going to put you on the spot here. What is one cool thing that we're going to see from brands at the Tokyo Olympics?
I think it's going to be immersive fan experiences. You know, whether it's Intel using their technology or potentially Visa with payment systems, Airbnb. So I think it's going to be about the fan experience for me.
Okay. Anyone else want to add?
Well, obviously, it's going to be dreams talking about how important sleep is to the performance of their athletes. So it's going to be incredibly cool.
Plenty of Z's. Anyone else?
I think it's how the brands, I'll use the Team GB brands as in general, all 13 of them and potentially a few more as well, how they utilise that in-the-moment magic. You know, that moment where hopefully Adam Beattie breaks a world record again and wins another gold medal, or maybe the hockey girls or men, you know, get a gold medal in a team sport like that. And how do they utilise that moment where the country is watching that sport, that person, and everyone's getting behind Team GB, and how they utilise it? And I think that's going to be really interesting.
Nick?
I think the fan experience thing is bang on. I think what a lot of people forget about London 2012 was the unique experience of going to the Olympic Park and being all those amazing activations. I think this could be finally the year where the likes of VR and AR actually come into play. I remember doing some stuff during London 2012 with some AR in a Holiday Inn with a BMX cyclist, and it was a great piece of activation, but I don't think anyone ever used it because it wasn't relevant for what they were trying to do. If this becomes part of the fan experience and actually it's making the experience better, and also you've got to look at the partners involved, the number of technological partners, both from a top point of view but also local market, you know, there will be some significant innovations that come out of this Games. I'm not going to go on record to say what they are as such, but that would be a trend that I would be expecting.
And the use of, I think, the use of social media. Mm. You know, we're 4 years on from the last summer. It's changed. Instagram stories didn't exist. TikTok didn't exist. So I think the way brands use that, the way consumers use that, you know, it's always that there will be something new that comes up, something that really basically generates a lot of excitement, I think.
Yeah, fantastic. Much to look forward to this August. We're going to substitute the Olympics now, send Olympics to the bench, and we're going to bring on football because there is another major tournament this year which takes place in multiple locations across the continent, Euro 2020. Now, I just wanted to ask our panel whether they have any idea in terms of brand interest for Euro 2020. Would anyone like to kick off?
Everyone's looking at me, so I'll kick off. Yeah, there's a lot of brand interest. I mean, obviously, Heineken just announced a few weeks ago, last month, that they're signing up a sponsor. Coca-Cola, we know, are going to be doing a lot around it as well. Mm-hmm. It's a very unique tournament from a football point of view, hosted across 12 countries. I think when they first announced it, as usual, people grumble and moan about these things. But I think we all very quickly realised it's going to be fantastic. I think the different passion you'll see from all the different sort of markets it goes to. I think the ability for brands to be able to market, you know, really in a really powerful way across those 12 markets is what's interesting to it. It's all these diverse cultures coming together. It's a bit of a cliche to say it, but it genuinely will be a celebrational festival of football because every country is going to put their sort of filter on it. And I think from a brand point of view, that's actually made it really interesting and as a sort of a really useful platform to attach a campaign to.
Is that a bit of a challenge logistically, though, when you're having all these multiple locations in completely different countries and cultures? How do brands sort of overcome that?
Well, brands like Coca-Cola and Heineken have no problem doing it because they do that day in, day out. You know, and I think if you look at a lot of the partners that the Euros have got on board, they'll have no problem doing it. So I think, you know, Coco and Heineken, I'm sure, will be embracing it because, you know, they both sit very comfortably, you know, in the world of football, and they've both been involved in it for many, many years. And I think they will be embracing the challenge and delivering some really good things for consumers.
The multi sort of country format as well opens it up to a lot of probably not sort of official partners to do activity. I know of a couple of brands that are looking at the, you know, the fact that London is going to be the host of some of the biggest games and seeing what they can do around the fact that there will be this festival of football, you know, in London at that time. And so from a kind of, you know, obviously traditionally, you know, we've been talking a lot about Rule 40 and some of the restrictions around being an Olympic sponsor. I think this summer there'll be a lot of people that have associations with football but not the Euros and UEFA that are looking at this as a great opportunity to engage with consumers but also make a big impact.
Can you give us some examples?
I can't give definitive examples because of the nature of the conversations we're having, but you know, you can imagine you know, somewhere, a nice central London location with a whole load of fans engaging with football. It opens up to a whole host of different partners that have been associated with football over the years, whether that be, you know, FMCG or beer or whatever it may be, because of the fact that, you know, that you can almost guarantee that there will be millions of people watching football, particularly when England are playing, and how can you be part of the conversation when that's happening?
Because I guess traditionally with one of these big global football events, you will have one location, you'll have one local beer sponsor and one sort of global beer sponsor, and that's it. So I guess what you're saying is there are plenty of opportunities in each of these locations for different local brands to get involved that otherwise might not get a look in.
Yeah, I mean, that would be, you know, as I said, there are, you know, these are early, you know, early conversations, but, you know, with 12 different markets, potentially there is the opportunity for 12 different sets of brands in those markets. Now, obviously the big UEFA-led fan parks, and one of the things UEFA is brilliant at is investing significantly in the big fans events around the key tournament locations. So I'd expect that to continue, and there, you know, your Coca-Colas and your Heinekens will own that experience. But it's more around in the cities or near the venues where these are going to take place. What are the opportunities for brands to kind of engage with consumers?
I think Nick's basically saying there's no Rule 40 for UEFA. UEFA do control it very well, but it's not the same level. So whatever, to go back to Olympics quick, briefly, whatever we might think of Rule 40, if you are a sponsor, it's absolutely right that they protect you. Because you pay a lot of money for those rights, and it should. And I know it's coming from some criticism with certain athletes feeling they can't thank their personal sponsors, but I personally think the Olympics are doing a very good job, you know, with managing and protecting their partners. UEFA will try, but Nick is absolutely right. There will be a lot of guerrilla activity around the Euros because it will be a lot easier to do it, and it'll be much harder for them, I think, to enforce it. And that's why you could find a lot of activity happening.
Does this sort of open it up to different categories that traditionally wouldn't get involved in football to have a go?
I don't see why not. It tends to be, you know, how does marketing work? People are very, you know, they react to what people are engaging with. You know, that's the history of marketing. But it tends to be around a big event. It's very difficult to build an audience from scratch when you have no rights or assets or heritage in that individual sport. So I would expect people that have had associations with football, or certainly have associations with football, to be the ones that are taking a lead role there.
Yeah, just to reinforce what the guys are saying, I mean, I think UEFA have been really smart for two reasons. There's the romantic reasons of 60 years football bridging Europe, but also from a commercial perspective, because they have they've unbundled the rights to the national men's tournaments, which are the Euros and the other, I can't remember the name of the tournament, the Nations League. They've got a tier of the tournament partners, and then there's also the potential of 24 partners across the 12 territories. So, wow. You know, this is the next point. You know, there potentially will be brands in certain countries go in and sponsor and be very innovative in the way they do it. So there will be a commercial uptick for the guys at UEFA as well. So I'm really excited about it.
I'm really interested to. There's so much football on at the moment. You've obviously got the Premier League, the Champions League, you've got the Euros, you've got various other tournaments throughout the calendar year and periodically. Is there almost a bit too much football for brands? I mean, is there a never-ending amount where the value proposition perhaps isn't as much as it might have been, and it's a bit cluttered?
I don't think so, because they don't overlap. I mean, football's the biggest sport in the world. The World Cup is still, you know, the most watched sporting event on the planet, and the Olympics is not that far behind. So football's huge. You know, the appetite for football is huge. And I think, you know, the various governing bodies do work very hard to try and not overlap. Mm. And they all offer, I think they all still offer something slightly different. And, you know, they are continuing to drive big commercial returns. More and more brands are buying into it. They're paying more and more money. The amount of rights fees being paid is going up year on year. The amount of people watching sport events continues to rise. So it's, you know, as a sport, I think it's in a pretty healthy state.
Okay. Well, I'm going to throw a bit of a curveball here, and that curveball is going to be thrown at Jamie C because he arrived a bit late. look, it would be a bit remiss of me not to mention the big sports sponsorship story of the week, and that is, of course, Manchester City. On the weekend, UEFA announced that they were going to ban Manchester City from the Champions League for 2 years, which Manchester City is obviously going to appeal. I just wanted to ask Jamie what your thoughts are about UEFA handing down that ban. Do you think it's fair, and what do you think will happen from here?
I think it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out over the next couple of months, especially with the Court of Arbitration. Will it be a two-year ban? Being a betting man, I would imagine that they'll cut that to 1 year. Am I surprised that it happened? Probably not. You know, a lot has been written about it. Mm. From a football perspective, it's going to be very interesting to see what's going to happen to City in terms of the players that are there at the moment, the manager, the coach. Do I think it impacts the Man City brand? No. I think they've created a very, very interesting model globally with their affiliations with other clubs, the City Football Group. So I don't know if I'm answering your question, but it's going to play out. It's going to be very interesting. The final part to that is, you know, are the clubs that we didn't realise may qualify for the Champions League next year, they may have a chance. So I'm a Man United fan, yep. And I'm kind of hoping that Man United might get in the Champions League next year. So, you know, it's going to be very interesting.
I believe we have a Tottenham fan in this panel as well. So,
yeah, I think it's our only chance of Champions League on current form. I think it's one of those things that is probably going to happen at some point when they put the FFP regulations in. And I don't think, with respect, that Man City was probably the biggest surprise to come out of that. That said, you know, I'd be amazed if Paris or one of the other clubs might be a little bit nervous at the moment, depending on how deep this investigation goes. But yeah, as a Spurs fan, my word, you know, fifth has suddenly become quite attractive. Whereas before, you try and avoid Europa League. Now you might try and go for fifth again. So we'll see.
I guess it's quite a big marker in the ground, isn't it, for UEFA? And the CAS appeal is going to be a very important watershed moment in the sport to really see if the rules have teeth. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to other sports and sports sponsorship trends more generally. I just wanted to ask both of you in terms of sports sponsorship, what are some of the key trends that we're seeing in the market? What are brands now looking for out of sponsorship deals today that they might not have looked for, say, you know, 5-10 years ago?
I think, you know, I did touch on this earlier, but, you know, certainly in my world at Team GB, we're having conversations around much more purpose-driven partnerships, and certainly what it can do for their employee base is conversations I don't think we were having, you know, maybe even as near as 4 or 5 years ago. You know, brands want to be seen, Jamie mentioned earlier, around, you know, being credible and authentic, and that's crucial, and actually, you know, without sounding too cheesy, kind of giving something back. So something like a partner like Aldi, yes, they create some amazing campaigns and there's a big media spend behind that about their association with Team GB, but actually probably some of their greatest work they do with us is, you know, across 26,000 schools up and down the country, almost reaching, hopefully by the end of this year, 1.2 million kids will have been through the Aldi Team GB Get Set program, encouraging children to be active, but also to eat the right foods and important messages like that. So those are the kind of activations that we're seeing more of, and long may it continue, because I think that's where marketeers and people at the top of the business making these decisions will hopefully, and being a sponsorship practitioner myself and someone who's been involved in the industry a long time, sponsorship will still continue and be appealing to brands if it's done in the right way. And I think those kind of initiatives are only going to help that.
Okay, well, let's touch a little bit on in terms of evaluation and ROI. What are brands looking for these? How are they measuring the value of packages?
Well, it'll vary obviously from client to client, and clients will go into them with sort of specific objectives. But fundamentally, to answer sort of both questions, I guess, in terms of what are brands wanting to get out of it and what's the evaluation model now is like, what do they want to get out of it? They need to know it's working. I think gone are the sort of romantic days of the CEO signing something because he likes cricket. You're not going to get away with that anymore. There's the IEG Sponsorship Decision Makers Survey, which is like the largest global survey of sort of all CMOs across all the major markets. So if you're involved in sponsorship now, sponsorship rights accounts for on average 17% of a CMO's total marketing spend. That's a huge amount. So they spend marketing money to get it back. You know, it's got to deliver sales, it's got to deliver brand love, it's got to deliver a whole host of metrics. So the reason why people want to get into it is because they believe that it can make a significant impact on their business. And it has to, frankly, because a lot of these deals are big money. So we do a lot of work with clients to basically, you know, help them justify, help them work on their evaluation methods. Some of our brands are doing a lot of work around econometrics. So you can actually, you can determine, for example, a cricket fan is worth X amount more to you as a business than a non-cricket fan. So therefore, if you're going to be involved in sponsorship of cricket, you need to target this target audience because they will be more commercially valuable to your business. So hopefully that answers both questions. They're getting into it because they want it to work for them commercially.
Hmm. What about in terms of, sorry, Jamie?
No, it was just to, again, what Jamie's saying, you know, partnerships, especially at a global level, can be truly transformational for a business. You know, and I know I keep talking about top partnerships, but, you know, you look at what you're spending on this, and there is brands going in there saying, we are going to spend this much money from now until 2028 because we want to change behavioural metrics, we want to change employees and the way they feel from a sentiment perspective, awareness, drive sales, and actually transform as a business, to Tim's point, you know, and it's the core of what that business is. And it's very interesting because, you know, we all work in communications and there is this change and shift towards communication being imperative from a strategic perspective when you're speaking to board people and they're just making decisions on, actually, we should have a partnership, you know. Gone are the days where it was just tactical. You know, tactics are still important and you will have clients that want tactics, but I think this is really about strategy and measurement because you are spending money. And just going back to what Jamie said, you know, it's not chairman swim anymore where I like cricket and I'm going to spend a lot of money on cricket.
Of course, there's also going to be an element of risk involved in sponsorship as well. And I imagine clients are now much more sensitive to some of those risks. Is that so what you're noticing? Are they doing their due diligence much, much more carefully?
There's a risk in any business, isn't there, in any walk of life. But I think it's important. You know, there's a lot more positive stories around sport than there are negative ones. You know, and hopefully this summer with both the Euros, but in particular with the Olympics, will prove that. And I think if brands are absolutely laser visioned in what they want to achieve through a partnership, set their objectives, measure it as well, then they'll get success. You can't legislate for things you can't control. What you can legislate for is making sure that your campaigns and your activations are, you know, done to the best of your ability and reaching a target audience and reaching the metrics that you've set yourself. And, you know, as we discussed earlier in the Olympics part, you know, there's so many positive, you know, amazing stories, particularly in the Olympics, whether that's someone winning a gold medal or someone just making the start line and everything in the middle, that for brands to get on the back of that and you know, be involved in the greatest show on earth is truly something quite special.
Okay.
Yeah, I think brands have to embrace that. They have to go into it with their eyes open, but they have to go into it with a clear strategy of what they deem, you know, appropriate values and what they deem inappropriate values, and have a plan and act on it decisively when something does go wrong. But sport is unpredictable, and that's why we love it. If we knew what was going to happen, no one would watch it. So, you know, brands getting you're dialing into sports sponsorship because as a brand you want to get closer to your consumers' passions. So you have to kind of become a fan and a supporter as well. So you've got to get the balance right. You can't just jump ship at the first time of trouble because the fans wouldn't. But that's when you have to understand like what's considered good brand values versus bad brand values. Nike, you know, famously did not leave Tiger Woods. And I think they did pretty well out of it from that partnership. So whereas all his other sponsors jumped ship. I mean, it was a personal issue at the time. Saracens, other issues out there are completely different. But I think, yes, you just need a plan for what's right and what's wrong.
Okay, we're heading deep into extra time here. I've got one final question before the final whistle goes. What one sporting moment are you looking forward to most this year? We'll start off with you, Tim.
I mean, there's hundreds of events in the Olympics. I am very excited to see Sky Brown, who could potentially become our youngest ever Olympian on her skateboard, should she qualify. But I I'm a big Adam Peaty fan, and I would love to see him get the gold medal again and break a world record. I think that's probably the moment I'm most excited about. But I'm hoping there are many, many exciting moments to enjoy come Tokyo 2020.
Is it Jamie?
Oh God, there's so many.
You got to pick one.
Got to pick one. I'm really looking forward to the Euros across 12 different markets. I can't wait for it. I think it's going to be. Sorry, Tim, you want me to say Olympics, don't you? It's the Olympics, obviously, because Tim sat to my right. I think the Euros is going to be a really great tournament, actually.
Yeah, and I'll echo that. And I mean, the potential of England playing in a major final at Wembley would be amazing. But I'm going to have to probably chuck in an Olympic one as well. One story that really struck me in 2012 was Laura. She's now Kenny, and the ability for her to come back now as a mum to potentially dominate the track again. You know, I think not only from a sporting point of view, but from a story point of view, that is the kind of thing that, you know, you could see the whole nation going completely mad for that. So that's a, you know, having followed her for as long as I have done, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I'm really excited by the Euros. Don't think Scotland will be there. We will need to have a big result against two teams to be there. From an Olympic perspective, I'm actually very excited about the golf. The reason being, I was there in Rio, and I saw what golf was in Rio, and I think it's just going to be huge. I think it's almost going to be on the level of a major, because Japan is crazy for golf. There was a big tournament there last year which Tiger Woods won, so I'm quite excited, and hopefully Justin Rose can defend his gold medal as well.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, being a Liverpool supporter, I'm looking forward to the mighty Reds finally lifting Premier League trophy after 30 years. I'm afraid that's all we have time for. I'd like to thank our sports panel, Tim, Jamie, Nick and Jamie, for playing this podcast with a straight bat and being really good sports. I'd also like to thank our production partner, Marketeers, and all of you for listening. We hope you enjoy this mega Olympics and football year of sport and get the most out of your investments in time and entertainment. Until next time, I'm Arvind Hickman. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the PR Show podcast with Arvind Hickman. Brought to you by PR Week. If you like what you heard, please leave us a nice review.